Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Because of the Las Conchas fire here in New Mexico, we have not been on the air. We are streaming on the web, and for that reason, I have re-aired a couple of programs. We have a new program in just a moment, and we're also going to rerun the program from yesterday with Gretchen Yost, veterinarian from the Espanola Valley Humane Society, talking about the fire and animals and other issues of animal shelter medicine. Thank you for listening to KSFR, whether it be on the air or on the stream. I'm delighted now to welcome to the show Rick Carver. He's a photojournalist and executive producer of the book A Year or So in the Life of New Mexico, an uncensored look at life in the land of enchantment, and Stacy Pearl, who is one of our KSFR producers and also the writer for almost all the essays in this book. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So this book is conceived of as, among other things, a benefit for Esperanza Shelter. How did that come about?
About 10 years ago, I retired myself as a photojournalist, and I hung up my cameras. About 4 years ago, I got the bug to take up photography again, and it was about that time that I hatched this idea of producing a book. And after a lot of soul-searching, we came upon an idea of doing a book about life in New Mexico and benefiting Esperanza in particular.
And so the photographs, was that where you started? You solicited photographs from basically anybody who wanted to take them?
I went around and did a lot of recruiting. I found a lot of photographers. The idea initially was anybody with a camera could take part in this project and submit photographs for possible publication in the book. And we ended up with 53 photographers.
And one of the criteria was they did not have to be professional photographers. We just wanted a commitment from them to photograph for an entire year, not just to have one photo in their repertoire, but to really commit to what their view of New Mexico looked like and then share that with us.
What an interesting project for somebody, whether they be professional or amateur, to engage in is say, okay, I'm going to take pictures of my view of New Mexico.
It's a great goal, and I think a lot of people got really excited about the idea that just with their simple tools, with their, you know, perhaps instant digital camera, they could have a published photograph in a book that would stand for something they could be proud of.
And so you had to recruit, basically, if this is going to be a book about New Mexico, people from all over the state.
That's exactly it.
How'd you do that?
I went to a number of the colleges that still have photography programs, like Santa Fe Community College and New Mexico State down in Las Cruces. And that was the initial way of recruiting photographers or students in photography who would have, this would be their first opportunity to get published.
And then we also went to photo stores, and we also went through professional photographers and asked them to connect to friends. And we used sort of the friends network, we used social media to connect to people, say, are you interested in New Mexico? You're taking photos? We want to see them.
And so you must have then gotten 5 gobzillion photos.
It was somewhere around 5,100.
Oh, okay. And so then you had to go through a very rigorous process of editing.
That was, for me, it was one of the hardest things to do, is to go through all those images and select what ended up being about 400 pictures for the book.
Now, did you start with the various categories in the book? For example, you've got nature and heroes and all sorts of things, treasures and helping hands and military and environment and rodeo. Did you start with those categories, or did the photograph suggest them?
From the beginning, the book, the whole project evolved as an ongoing, just an ongoing thing that just kept growing and growing. We wanted to publish a book that described the beauty of New Mexico, plus some of the issues involving all of us who live here, including DWI and homelessness, et cetera, et cetera.
So we did have a basic list of categories that we expected to cover. However, the photos developed in different ways. So, for instance, I don't think we were aware at the beginning what an important part the rodeo would play. We were unaware what a big part of New Mexican life that was on both professional, college, and young adult level.
And so, on Indian reservations. And
right. You know, for a lot of people, I mean, that was one of my more fascinating interviews because we went to the rodeo and I interviewed a lot of the bull riders, and I hadn't realized that for them, this was their only option. A lot of these guys grew up on the ranch. Their parents had done well. They had no other job skills, and this was like the big golden ring. There are guys on that rodeo tour who've earned $1 million. And so it was really fascinating to see that whole part of life, which I frankly didn't even know existed in New Mexico. So we covered that quite extensively.
Yes, and one of the beauties of this book is discovering all these photographs by all these different people. And, I mean, you've put an uncensored look. What did you mean by that?
When I recruited for this book, I said that there would be absolutely no censorship. No subject matter would go untouched. Anything was on the table.
So it didn't have to all just be chilies and pueblos.
Not at all.
I think we've got that covered. I think there are many books
you
that have been
published.
You think
there's a few other books about those
I think
things?
There's one or two that cover the beautiful hand-painted mailboxes on Canyon Road, and they're lovely. But we felt like life here is, I mean, true diversity is so much more complex, and the problems are so intense in this state. It's a very difficult place for a lot of people to make a living, and it has so many cross-cultural references. And we thought no one ever talks about that, you know.
Except on this show, we
talk about. You do, of course. But I mean, in terms of like books about New Mexico,
yeah.
You know, the hunger issue, the DWI issue, are things that affect more people's lives than the gorgeous sunset.
Right.
So we felt that was really our niche that we could, and there are a lot of people who are very concerned about those things and wanted to photograph them.
So one of the things that you have, well, let's start with the very beginning. It's sort of funny that it starts with a kind of archaeology, the ruins of New Mexico, but a lot of the ruins are 20th century ruins, broken gas pumps and buildings that are completely abandoned and eaten out by weather, but they're still there and you can just barely make out what they are.
We're really blessed in New Mexico having a lot of really good photographers, and every time we go out looking for things to photograph, we find those beat up mailboxes and the rundown gas stations, and New Mexico's got a lot of that, and they're a good fodder for a good photographer.
They're so poetic. those moments on the road are so poetic.
They really are.
Yeah.
And you also have a section on big coal and basically the damage that the pollution is doing to our state and particularly people on the Navajo Reservation.
Yes, and we were fortunate enough to get a very accomplished writer, Mary Beath, to write that piece of text. She is an environmental expert and a photographer and an artist. And she was very interested in covering that for us, and so she wrote that essay.
We're talking to Rick Carver and Stacy Pearl about the book A Year or So in the Life of New Mexico, an uncensored look at life in the land of enchantment. Now, this actually took more than a year to put together, I take it.
Probably 2.5 years, I think.
It's because Rick can't say no to anyone.
Yeah, I can't.
All
say
along
no.
The process, when we kept having a cutoff date, someone else would say, "Oh, I didn't know about this. I'd love to participate." And Rick would say, "Of course, start taking pictures."
Right.
So that's sort of the nature of our time frame.
Well, and it worked out so well because the pictures are, I've never quite seen a book like this. They're spectacular and they're dramatic, but they're expressive in a lot of different ways. And there they are all next to each other, and each one has, I mean, they're, some photographers have more than one photograph in there, but there's a really wide variety of people.
And one of Rick's goals was that pretty much everybody who submitted photos has at least one photo in the book.
Right.
So nobody was left out. Because it's a lot of work for somebody to take photos for us. And they did this out of kindness. Nobody was paid for anything. And so we felt the least we could do is at least include one. But some of the photographers submitted hundreds of photographs, one photographer. And so we included as many as we thought were excellent, and there were quite a few.
There's a place called the Wildlife West Nature Park.
In Edgewood. Owned by Roger A. Link,
yeah.
A very nice gentleman, and all the wildlife over there are rescued wildlife from somewhere around New Mexico.
It's a beautiful spread about him and about these animals in the book and gives you a sense of yet another person who is giving their life in this way that is understated and important and beautiful all at the same time.
He was an amazing man. It was so great to interview him. He was so kind. He was so gentle. And his only concern was helping the animals and educating youth into our environment. He gets no funding. It's all volunteer work. And he does it out of love. I mean, he's an amazing man.
Now, you also look at Esperanza Shelter, food banks, Joy Junction, all sorts of institutions that are helping people. Maybe you could talk about some of those a little bit, because Esperanza is the recipient of whatever benefit comes from this book.
They will get all the benefit from this book. Roadrunner in particular, Joy Junction also. I had no idea when I started this that I would run into, I would see firsthand a lot of the problems. I mean, my goodness, Roadrunner is a huge warehouse in Albuquerque, and they feed thousands every month. And all these people are pretty much destitute. They need food. And if it wasn't for people like Roadrunner, they'd starve.
And Roadrunner is a place also where I spent a little bit of time, and I interviewed some of the people who work there and the people that run it. And they had just purchased this space that was the size of a football field, and they already saw that they were going to run out of space because every single day their needs were increasing. And not only do they have a food bank where they distribute food, they have five or six different programs, one particular which I thought was fascinating, where they have a backpack program because they realized a lot of the children, when they're not in school on the weekends, have no meals. So they send them home with backpacks full of food, which they pack very carefully with things that aren't sharp, with shelf-stable food, so the kids could have things to eat on the weekends, and they return the backpack on Monday, and on Friday they get it again to go home. These are programs I don't think a lot of people know about.
Yeah, exactly. And so well-conceived to actually address the problem at hand.
Yes, and most of that is volunteer help. And something I didn't know about them was that they purchase something like I think it was 70 or 80% of the food they have to buy. They get donations, but the needs are so enormous that they go out and purchase their foods. And they have a walk-in that's the size of, like, most people's homes, full of, you know, perishables and non-perishables, and they repack things. The amount of labor involved in getting food out to the people is enormous. And I should also mention that they welcome people to come visit them and tour the facility.
Now, there's also, speaking of nutrition, a picture that really struck me, which is a booth where they're selling deep-fried Twinkies.
Unfortunately, that is a part of the New Mexican diet.
Deep-fried Twinkies, deep-fried Oreos, deep-fried candy bars, and deep-fried cheesecake are all available. Where is this thing?
Yum.
State fairs?
That was a picture taken from the state fair a couple of years ago.
Amazing.
It was amazing.
You can't get that at the food bank, nor should you.
No.
No.
But there's some other things, too. I mean, when you look through this book, it's almost like a state of so many subcultures that really don't interact with each other. I mean, it's a
true
lot of worlds. Like, you've got the Rainbow Gathering, you've got roller derby, you've got the military.
And I think that's one of the things that I think a lot of people who are involved in one of those groups are not aware of the others. I mean, for instance, the roller derby. Roller derby is the fastest growing female sport in America. It's the only full contact sport. And New Mexico has a great roller derby league, and it's an absolutely fantastic way to go spend your time. There's rules. It's not just a free-for-all. It's not like the bad movies. It's an actual sport, and it's so much fun, and there is a whole culture that goes with it.
I know. We've talked about it on this show. I didn't even know it was there until some of the very nice and amazingly athletic ladies came.
Yes.
And
don't mess with them.
Do not mess with roller derby ladies.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen. And then, of course, we can't forget the Rainbow Gathering, which is not always, of course, in New Mexico.
Right. Rick, you enjoyed that, didn't you?
That was a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to take some really unique pictures. And I think you would agree that there are three in there that are pretty unique.
Psychedelia lives on, ladies and gentlemen. The book is a year or so in the life of New Mexico. Rick Carver and Stacey Pearl with us here on the Radio Cafe. Some of the other things, aliens in Roswell. One sort of mysterious photo that looks like an alien autopsy.
Well, there's lots of rumors floating around about those aliens, and all I can say is if you look at the pictures, a picture's worth 1,000 words, you can believe it or not.
Well, I need the 1,000 words.
Rick loves the aliens, and he loves talking the whole Roswell culture, and it is a great place to take photographs. And the whole town is just so alien crazy. They have developed an entire tourist agenda based on these aliens, and I think it's hysterical. And people from all over the world, my relatives in England said, have you ever been to Roswell?
Right.
So I think, you know, it's sort of, to me, funny. A lot of people, it's quite serious. You know, when you have, you know, and, you know, you have all the conspiracy theorists who just love to go there and talk about, you know, what is it called, 51?
Area 51.
Area 51.
Which right. is actually in Nevada.
Right.
About which there's a new book.
Is there?
Yes. I just saw an interview about it on television the other night, and the theory about what, well, we won't get into that right
okay.
now, ladies and gentlemen.
But once again, an important part of life in New Mexico is
exactly.
the whole alien agenda.
Right. The alien agenda. Now, there's quite a bit of Native American photographs in here, too, and you have other people writing essays?
Yes. One of my friends, Elena Ortiz, who is married to a Native American and spends a lot of time on the reservation, and her children interact and with all the other Native Americans, and they do the powwow. And she's very knowledgeable, and I thought, well, I should let her write those pieces because she knows what she's talking about. She's an excellent writer, and she was kind enough to write us some piece. And Rick got some really excellent access to some of the powwows and the rodeo, and spent a good deal of time taking those photos, and it was a really good experience, wasn't it?
It was a special occurrence. One thing occurred to me at the beginning of the project was that having Native American pictures in the book were very important to me. And the Navajo Nation is a very large area, including New Mexico.
Right.
So it counted to me to have that included as part of life in New Mexico. That was very special.
Now, you took some of the photographs in the book.
Yes. I took a lot. There were a lot of things that if I hadn't have made arrangements to take the pictures myself, they would not have been included in the book. The section on the USS New Mexico, that would not have occurred had I not gone made arrangements to go to Norfolk, Virginia for the commissioning.
So the book is called A Year or So in the Life of New Mexico, An Uncensored Look at Life in the Land of Enchantment. Rick Carver is the executive producer. I always think of that as a film thing, but I guess that's really what the job was for this book. And Stacy Pearl wrote almost all the essays in the book. It's available at our local bookstores here
yes,
in New Mexico.
It will also be available directly through the Esperanza website, and that's probably the best place to get it because the funds go right to them. It is also for sale on our website, which is www.ayearorsonm.com. It could be purchased directly through our website, and we will have it in the local bookstores as soon as it is out to be launched very shortly.
And the Esperanza Shelter's website is esperanzashelter.org. Now, before we go, there is also something that's happening tonight, Thursday night, the 30th of June, which is a benefit for Kim Mueller. Tell us about that. She's a wonderful chef
Kim
here.
Kim is a chef here in town. She's worked at some of the best establishments. She's been into local and organic and sustainable before it was fashionable. And she's experiencing some very poor health at the moment. And my friend Nof El-Kazemi has put together an amazing benefit to raise some money for her while she convalesces. And the benefit is going to be taking place at Rio Chama from 6 to 8.
And you can go to MuellerBenefit.com. That's MuellerBenefit.com.
That is correct. There will be an amazing dinner. All the best restaurants in town have donated food for the event. There will be a fantastic auction with food gifts and travel gifts and restaurant gifts. And we're just trying to raise money for Kim to make it a little easy for her and hopefully to regain her health.
Now, tickets will not be available at the door, ladies and gentlemen. So if people want to go, they have to buy tickets on the website. And once more, the website is MuellerBenefit.com.
Right. You could go to Facebook. You could find it there.
Right.
And there's still a few tickets left. And it's going to be a great evening. It's going to be very, very festive. And we're hoping to raise a whole lot of money for Kim.
Well, thank you for sharing that. Thank you for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
I'm very happy now to welcome to the program Gretchen Yost. She is a veterinarian with the Española Valley Humane Society. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
So before we talk about anything else having to do with veterinary medicine and shelter medicine and things like that, let's talk for a moment about this fire that is going on. Los Alamos has a mandatory evacuation, and that has a tremendous impact on animal shelters in this area.
Absolutely. We have taken in about 96 animals. Most of them all came in after the mandatory evacuation was put in order. Folks coming down and checking into hotels or checking in with friends who unfortunately couldn't take their animals with them. So we decided early on and planned for it that we would try to get our animals, shelter animals, out into foster care and make room and make preparations for evacuees. We had no idea how many we'd actually have. There weren't actually that many for the Cerro Grande fire. But I don't think we as an organization put out the announcement that we would take animals at that time. This time we did, and so a little bit ambitious there, but it's all been very good, I think, for the animals, but ultimately for these, poor people that have had to evacuate.
So when people evacuate, they leave their houses, and sometimes they go stay at a hotel that doesn't take animals, or they stay at friends' houses who, for whatever reason, can't take animals.
Exactly, allergies or too many animals already, or too many, people, not enough room. So I'm just very thankful that the people brought their pets with them. I had the opportunity to go down to Katrina after that hurricane, and as you know, there were lots and lots and lots of pets that were forced to be left behind. They wouldn't, they were
that
not.
That was one of the greatest travesties of the United States emergency system ever, is that they would not take people who insisted on bringing their pets. You had to either let your pets die or die with your pets.
Absolutely. It was. And I remember a little old man that stayed in knee-deep water with his dog for 4 or 5 days, and his son forced him to evacuate in a boat, and but they would not let the dog come with them, and they were reunited weeks later, amazingly. But most animals were not reunited with their owners. I mean, they a lot of them got new homes, which was terrific, but
and a lot of them died that didn't have to die.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So here we have people evacuating with their pets, and so the animals that you already had at the shelter, those are the ones that you've been trying to find foster homes for.
Absolutely. And we did this, we kind of had a dry run back in February when we had the freeze in northern Mexico, and we lost the gas in Española. And at the shelter, we lost not only heat but also water. And you can't really run a shelter like that. So within hours, we were able to mobilize our volunteers to come, and we cleared out the shelter in, like I said, a matter of hours. So this time, it's kind of double the effort, because not only do we have to get our animals out, but, check the evacuees in. So, luckily, it's all gone fairly smoothly, amazingly enough.
The animals that are being fostered out,
mm-hmm.
those are also, if somebody who's fostering them falls in love with them, do they get to adopt them?
Absolutely. Yes. There's applications, adoption applications, but there's also foster applications too. So anybody that we would foster to would be a wonderful home, for an adoption. So we actually call that failed fostering, because and I'm guilty of it myself, of adopting a foster. But ultimately, finding homes for these guys is what we're all about. So we'll definitely take that.
So we will see what happens, and we'll get updates in the coming days as this fire progresses, or maybe with some luck it'll rain, or who knows what will happen.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of open-ended. We are prepared if we had to evacuate to evacuate all these animals with us elsewhere. So you always have to kind of keep that in mind too. But hopefully that won't come to that.
So the Santa Fe Animal Shelter, I mean, you guys are full at this point. I think Santa Fe is still accepting animals that need foster homes or that need a place to crash for a while.
They sure are, and we've been very impressed by the number of calls we've got from Albuquerque veterinary clinics, local veterinary clinics and all kinds of people and organizations that say, let us know if you need any help, if you need any place to put animals. And so once again, we're blessed and pleased with the positive part of this tragedy. So,
what can people do who are listening who want to either donate their homes or donate stuff? What is the Espanol shelter need at this point?
Well, thanks for asking. Right now, we can always use volunteers. Call the shelter first. Depending on what the situation is, it might be walking some dogs. It might be cleaning. Obviously, there's a lot of cleaning to do when you've got so many animals that you're feeding and caring for every day. We are asking for cat litter, the non-clumping kind, and we can always use food and dry food, puppy food, cat food. Dog food, yeah.
Have most of the animals that have come in been dogs, cats, equal amount of both, anything else?
Mostly dogs, I'd have to say, but I have been surprised at the number of cats that have also come in. And we did actually get two birds, and there was a bird rescue that contacted us and said that they'd be willing to take those birds because, birds can be stressed, and so it's better for the birds to be in a low stress environment. So that's where they are now.
I would think birds would be stressed if there were cats and dogs around.
Absolutely. Well, we kind of had them separate, but still, it's controlled chaos there. So it's good to get the birds out.
We're talking to Gretchen Yost from the Espanola Valley Humane Society. So let's talk for a moment about shelter medicine. You are a veterinarian at an animal shelter. That's something that we haven't really talked about much on this show. There's a lot of veterinarians in private practice, I suppose, but you're a shelter vet. Is that a whole career path for people?
It sure is. And it used to be, I think, even when I was in vet school, and that was graduated 11 years ago, it seemed to be the place where you thought about retiring. Nobody actually thought about going as a new veterinarian into shelter medicine, and that's really turned around. And now there are specialty programs, certain classes that you can take in vet school, and kind of a renewed respect for the field, and a lot more science that's going behind it, and trying to do this well in terms of taking care of large volumes of animals in a stressed situation. And so vaccination protocols, how do you house them properly, how do you lower stress environmentally, it all plays a part in animal health. And ultimately, you keep the animals as healthy as possible, and then you can find homes for them better. Yeah.
What are some of the differences between a regular veterinary clinic and being a veterinarian at a shelter?
Being a small animal veterinarian in private practice, and I did that for about 7 years in a clinic in Espanola, it's a very hands-on with a single animal and then the client. I mean, there's a client-patient-animal relationship that you have with every single interaction. And there's always, there's lots of diagnostics, and you have to depend upon the owner and their finances a lot to determine, how far you can go diagnostically with an animal. But, ultimately you have more resources because you're dealing with an owner. In shelter medicine, you're dealing with a lot of animals, and a lot of these animals they don't come in the best of health. There's nobody that can tell you a history about them. Typically, most of our animals are strays, or they're dropped in our drop box, so often I wish I had a medical history, but we don't have that luxury. And certainly, it's always, finances are going to be always an issue in the shelter environment, because there's just not enough money to do all those high diagnostics. And so you have to be more reliant upon, upon things like your stethoscope and a microscope. And it's a different world. But you know, I love it because these are the absolute most helpless and hopeless, not really, but needy animals that there are. I mean, there's not anybody advocating for them, so I feel very, very fortunate to be in a place that I get to advocate for them.
It sounds sort of like being a doctor in a third world clinic or something like that.
You know, I always say when I'm trying to describe this that it's kind of like the Peace Corps of veterinary medicine, you know, up there in Española. We're faced with a lot of challenges, and I kind of sought that out as a veterinarian, so that's why I kind of ended up in private practice there too. Not so different from the shelter, dealing with a poor community. You know, they're not able to do as much for their animals, and so you are relying on the amazing strength of actually the body and the healing, and to pull animals through.
When you are working at a clinic that's really outfitted and has the latest and greatest stuff, what is some of the latest and greatest stuff in terms of diagnostics and treatment?
Wow. It's been a while since I've been in one of those places, but absolutely, and I'm very, very glad that these practices are out there and my colleagues are out there that specialize. But you can literally do for an animal most anything you could do for a person. I mean, there are specialists in everything from ophthalmology to cancer to neurology.
They don't give them cataract operations.
Absolutely.
They do?
Yes, ma'am. Yeah. That's old news.
Really?
Yeah, it is. No, I was going to give you a price per eye, but that's long ago, so
right,
I don't.
Right.
Yeah. But absolutely. Absolutely.
And they have defibrillators and all the cardiac stuff for animals?
Sure. You can, there's, very standard to have echocardiograms done on your animals to diagnose murmurs and things like that. And then depending upon the condition, and, you know, it's amazing, but animal physiology is almost exactly like humans. I mean, they just have hair and tails, you know, but everything that can happen to us can happen to them, you know, in terms of cardiac issues that might, well, actually they don't get the sclerosis, and, you know, so they don't need bypass surgeries, but I guess they eat better than we do.
We're talking to veterinarian Gretchen Yost. So it does actually bring up for me a kind of question about whether animals should get the same level of medical care that human beings get in a society where human beings don't get sufficient medical care.
Well, I'm often told by folks that that sometimes they wish that their veterinarian was their doctor.
I feel exactly that way.
And not so much because, that we don't do as much, but I think we, as veterinarians, And the way veterinary medicine is structured in this country is that you do have that general practitioner that you go to, and we look at the whole animal. We look at the eyes and the feet and the heart, and we touch the animal because you have to. You have to have physical contact with the animal, to diagnose it, because you're not able to talk to them, so I think. Because of that, you get a more global picture of a medicine of an individual. And sometimes I know I feel like human medicine is they're just focused on their organ system, and they don't see everything. And I apologize to any EMDs are out there; they're under the gun, doing a lot of great stuff. But
right.
So
it's really, without calling itself that, it's just by definition a kind of holistic medicine.
I absolutely think so. It's very hands-on, and of course I'm glad that there are specialists out there that you can, as a general practitioner, go ahead and get that cataract surgery done. You wouldn't want me doing that, absolutely. But for somebody who wants that done, it's there and it's safe and it's available, and I think people are demanding that, you know.
What are the kinds of medicine or the kinds of procedures that you most frequently do in an animal shelter?
Well, that's easy. Spay neuter. It's all about spay neuter.
Yes.
And so that's kind of one of the things that as a, you know, that's why shelter medicine was thought, well, you know, you want to retire there because you don't want to deal with people anymore. Maybe you can sit in the back room and you can do lots of spays and neuters and not deal with quote-unquote hard medicine. That's not what I think, even though I do lots of spay neuters. And you become kind of an expert at that, and it's your niche. And you can do a lot more, and you can do them very safe, which is what we do to hopefully prevent the numbers, you know, of animals coming in that we have to find homes for. But, you know, every once in a while, and, well, not too infrequently, animals will come in with lacerations or wounds or things that you need to, you know, to do surgery on. I've done a few amputations, some intestinal surgery, some things that, and eye, you know, taking out eyes, you know, if they have to, which is not my favorite thing to do, but when it has to be done. So we, yes, we specialize in spay neuter, but if a shelter animal is adoptable and needs something else and we're able to do it with our equipment there, we'll do it. And if it's the difference between doing it and not doing it, and that animal doesn't have a chance at a home.
To what extent do you engage in education in the community so that the kind of problems that are coming in won't happen as often?
Not enough. I wish we had unlimited funds to do that, to make that even a bigger part of our program at the Humane Society. You know, I'd like to, it'd be great to get out to all the schools and every kid in every classroom, and because I think that there's a lot to be gained by talking and showing the human-animal bond and reconnecting, you know, with kids and animals, because they're the ones that are going to change things in the future. But, you know, we do some of that, absolutely, but, you know, always looking for help to do more.
So ideally, with more funding, you'd have more education programs and get out into all the schools and all of that.
Absolutely, yeah. We do have a few, you know, great volunteers that, you know, are teachers as well. So, you know, some of them bring their classes to the shelter, and they volunteer, and they really do work, and they do little fundraisers to, you know, to raise funds for the shelter, and there's a nice connection there. So any teacher out there that wants to kind of have that partnership, please let us know. We'd love to have that.
Now, you actually ended up adopting a dog who had quite a dramatic story.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about that.
Jack. He's our famous dog now.
Yeah, yeah. Wow. He's been in the paper, everything.
Absolutely. And people from coast to coast seems like have heard about Jack. Yeah, Jack came in, and you know, I think he's older than the hills. Probably close to 13, 14, 15, and he's a heeler. Very gray in the face, one floppy ear down, one up. He came in with, gosh, how do I even, you know, describe this without being too grisly, but his right arm was essentially dead and mostly bone. And it had been that way a long time, very infected, and it needed an emergency amputation. The person that brought it in, you know, said at first he'd had him for 6 weeks and then said no. So investigation is pending on that. It happened to be actually a police officer, which made us kind of crazy. So
because there was a suspicion that the dog had been abused or neglected.
Well, you know, definitely neglected. If indeed this dog, Jack, was with this person for 6 weeks with his arm in such shape, I can't. It's just unconscionable that you don't do something about it. You know, even if it's I can't do anything, please, you know,
please
let him go. Yeah. Or yes, absolutely. Even if you don't have the money, and that's what we, you know, we absolutely want people to come to us, and we will try. I mean, I can't, you know, say that we will we'll be able to have the resources to fix every animal or whatever, but at least they have a chance and they don't have to suffer, and we'll relieve their pain and, you know, perhaps get them to a place where they can actually have a home. But don't let them suffer out there. And, the fact that he was a police officer just kind of elevated the thought that, you know, do you even realize that this is severe neglect, you know? And so we did push the issue, and there is a case pending for neglect and cruelty. In the meantime, Jack was a real trooper. We amputated the leg the next day, he was severely sick, and so I took him home for recuperation, all the while thinking that I'm just going to get him well, and then we'll find him a wonderful home. And his story got out there and touched so many people. We had lots of donations from far and wide, you know, $5 here, $25 there. It was very touching, and certainly enough to take care of him and many others, actually, that don't get so famous, you know. long story long, he's much better, and I thought I could let him go, but, you know, I just couldn't. So
another failed foster.
Absolutely. So I'm actually a little feel a little guilty about that, but.
But Jack is a happy dog.
He's a happy dog. Yep. And certainly one of our many, many success stories. So maybe through his plight, you know, we get donations so that we can help other animals medically. But maybe there's some folks, you know, locally that are kind of rethinking the whole animal cruelty neglect thing, and that, you know what, we're going to take this seriously, and, you know, maybe this will or won't, you know, have any legal implications, but we're not just going to look the other way.
There's so much to be said about the phenomenon of compassion, whether it be for other human beings or whether it be for other animals, noticing the suffering of others and doing what you can to alleviate it. And you can't save everybody, and everybody knows that, but when it's right in front of you, there's something you can do.
Absolutely, and you need to recognize it. So I fear that some are a little numb to this, and you would hope that it wouldn't be your law enforcement. Because, you know, whether it's a dog, or, you know, whether it's you know, a child or an old person, you know, all the innocent, and maybe the ones that can't quite tell us exactly where they hurt or why they hurt or who hurt them, they're all kind of in one boat, and we need to recognize and be empathetic to all creatures. So
we're talking to veterinarian Gretchen Yost. Now, how are we doing in northern New Mexico, in the areas that you see, in terms of education on the importance of spaying and neutering one's animals? I know that we've talked about this on the show a number of times, that Colorado's spay-neuter programs have been so successful that they have to import puppies from New Mexico. But we seem to still have an overabundance of unwanted animals because of people not spaying and neutering their pets.
Sure. And, you know, I would say there's much, much, much more work to be done. There's certainly, we do in Española, we at our clinic 15 to 20 a day, and you would think, and that's up to a little over 3,000 a year. They do many here in Santa Fe at the spay neuter clinic, and of course private veterinarians are doing it all the time too. You would think that would make that would be all you would need, but not the reproductive rate is so high that it just seems like we're having a hard time keeping up with everything. There's certainly, in a given day, there's certainly animals that I spay or neuter that, and I'm thinking, well, I think that the owner probably would have done that anyway, or these animals are probably in a house and they probably wouldn't have had puppies. But there are some that come in and you go, I'm so glad I am spaying this one that's probably had 5 litters already and probably going to have 5 more, and if I didn't do this. So I think it's challenging in our world to find those animals, and to get into those communities or find Those are the ones that you need to get out there and spay and neuter. And they call that now, the buzzword is targeted spay neuter. And so that's going to be our challenge moving forward, is maybe analyzing more of our intake. Where are these animals coming from? Who are they coming from? And getting out into those communities and going door to door, or bringing the animals to the shelter for spay neuter. Of course, when you're looking at that, the cost per spay or neuter just climbs.
Of course. Now, you started out, veterinary medicine is your second career. You started out as an electrical engineer. How did you switch over to this whole new life of becoming a veterinarian?
I was very lucky. I could follow my dream. I'd always thought about being a veterinarian, being a little girl. And I think a lot of little girls go through that phase anyway. And then I took a trip to Auburn Vet School. And I saw heartworms in a jar, or something that really kind of wigged me out a little bit. And also, I used to, and I still do, cry at every single animal movie. Do not ask me to go to any animal movie. So everybody in my family said, "You can't be a veterinarian. You can't." So I said, "Oh, okay. I'll go over here and do this math and science thing that I like." And it was a good career, but I found that I was writing all my checks, to the animal organizations, and I thought, well, why not get into the game? I'm able to, and so I decided to go down that road and take night classes, and then apply to vet school, and was lucky enough to get in, lucky enough to have some life savings that I could plunk down into a 4-year vet school. And
it's harder to get into, I've heard, vet school than medical school.
I think we veterinarians tell you that. I don't know. It makes us seem smart. I don't know about that. I know that there's fewer vet schools. There's only like 28 vet schools
right.
in the country. So, but I don't know if
that may be part of it.
Yeah,
is that there's just so many people who want to go to vet school. Did you meet other people who were doing second careers like you?
A few, sure. One of my best friends, she was a paramedic before and decided to go back. So we were kind of the older girl sat in the back row, and the mother hens, I suppose, of the class. So
what is the greatest reward for you of being a shelter veterinarian?
I just as tired as I am at the end of every day, and that's physically and emotionally, I suppose, I feel really, really lucky that I actually have a job I care about. And I just don't think that a lot of people have that luxury of caring about it, about what they do. Every little life that I can touch and make better makes me better, makes me a better person, I think. And so I that's, was that the question? I don't know. I kind of got off into my teary stuff. So
no, but I mean, if you cry at animal movies, do you cry when you, does it hurt you when you lose an animal that you're caring for?
Sure. Absolutely. I you do kind of become a little bit, and you have to kind of philosophical about end of life. And I think on a personal level, that's helped me with losses in my life. My father passed away last year, and I think I've been able to handle that better because I'm around the circle of life so much, and I realize, and in my own head, I think I just know I'm going to see all these guys again, and I kind of picture when I kind of cross that rainbow bridge that all these little fluffy things are going to just come and just pounce on me, and I certainly hope it's that way anyway. So it makes
in the
me
sky where there is no animal shelter and they're all free.
Exactly, and they're all healthy, and they're all free of everything, it's all good. So
once again, if people want to get in touch with the Española Valley Humane Society and make any donations of time, money, food, or anything else during this fire season, what should they do?
Absolutely. Give us a call at the shelter. 753-8662 is our number. And we've got, if you're interested in fostering, they'll connect you to our foster coordinator, volunteer coordinator. If you're interested in volunteering, we can give you the latest thing that we might have run out of, be it paper towels or cat litter. If you are at the store and want to buy something. And of course, monetary donations of any amount are always welcome. It's always tough. It's a tough environment.
Gretchen Yost is veterinarian at the Espanola Valley Humane Society. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.